This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
So we talked, now this is the late phase of Wittgenstein, which is sometimes called ordinary language philosophy. So the three forms of language analysis so far, logical atomism, logical positivism, and now ordinary language philosophy, which represents the later work of Wittgenstein. And I've been sort of going through some of his typical statements that language has a wide variety of uses. There's a little point in stigmatizing language. See the notion, he's opposed now to the notion of a perfect language. The meaning of language is its use. He's opposed to reductionism. Also opposed to generalizations. This is the whole Platonic problem about what do we do with universals? What do we do with general terms which refer to things like triangularity and color and courage and all of that? And here Wittgenstein develops what has been called the concept of a family resemblance. He says, you know, when you have a family reunion, get all the Joneses together, and one will have the Jones nose, and another one will have the Jones ears, and another one will have the Jones hair, or the Jones receding hairline, whatever it may be. And all these people, you know, they gather together for a picture, and they kind of look similar to one another, but nobody necessarily, nobody has... There's no one characteristic that everybody has in common. So Wittgenstein, it's like that, says it's like that with the term game, for example. What is the essence of games? You know, what is it that all games have in common? Well, is it winning and losing? But there are games like Ring Around the Rosie where nobody wins and nobody loses. Are games performed for fun and no other motive? Well, but think about pro football, which is played for money. So all these, there's no single characteristic, he thought, that is common to all games. Nor is there any single characteristic that's common to all human beings, or common to all courage, or common to all general terms like that. So that's the family resemblance view of universals and particulars. Then G, his view of philosophy, he's still against metaphysics. He thinks metaphysics arises because people use words that are commonly used in the language, but they distort those uses. They try to use those words in other contexts in which they are inappropriate. Take, for example, the term time. If I ask you what time it is, there's nothing mysterious about that. You don't get all bewildered and start asking philosophical questions. If I ask you what time it is, you look at the clock and you tell me it's 9 minutes after 11. That's a language game. That's a use of the term time. But then if I'm a philosopher and I say, well, what is the essence of time? What is time really? Then you get all frustrated and you can't answer the question unless you've majored in physics or something. But so then I reply to you and I say, how can you tell me what time it is when you don't even know what time is? How can you tell me what time is when you don't know the essence of time? And Wittgenstein says that's the problem with metaphysics. They're always asking those dumb questions. Of course, you can use the word time without being able to define time. You know, kids use words all the time, and they can't define the uses of them. They talk about all kinds of things. They say, "Let's go in the house," but they can't define house. They don't know what the essence of a house is. So you don't need to know essences in order to be able to use words. The use of words comes before the identification of an essence. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that leads to philosophy. If the philosophers would just be content to use words in their ordinary meaning rather than trying to transport them into these inappropriate contexts where you start asking about essences and things, then they'd be okay. But unfortunately, they're always trying to, you know, get deeper than ordinary language, and so they get confused. They get they mess language up. The purpose of philosophy, then, is not to do metaphysics. It's not to develop some view of the essences of things. The purpose of philosophy is to cure confusions. It's therapeutic, just Wittgenstein said. The philosopher aims to cure those confusions by showing that such problems never arise when the word is rightly used, a word like time. Wittgenstein saw philosophy somewhat negatively. His disciples went beyond that a little bit. Top of 231, religion. He wrote some lectures on aesthetics, religion, aesthetic psychology, and religious belief, it's called. Religious language is a particular use of language. See, he's kind of open here, kind of generous. The logical atomist, in that phase, he'd say religious language is meaningless, unless it's mystical. Logical positivist would simply say it's meaningless, cognitively meaningless. Now, Wittgenstein is prepared to be a little bit more generous to religious people. He says, yeah, you know, religious language has a meaning. But you have to understand it's a meaning in a particular language game. It's a meaning in a particular context. Various groups of people use religious language for different purposes. There are some people who don't play that game. It's like some people play golf and other people don't play golf. Some people choose to be religious, and so they develop a religious language to carry out their rituals and to do things in their community. Other people opt out of that. They don't play that game. But any time people get together and they play a game, that is using words in a group of human transactions, the language is meaningful because the meaning of the language is its use in the game. But now Wittgenstein says you got to keep this in the proper context. Religious language, the religious game is not the same as the scientific game. And this is where a lot of confusion comes up, according to Wittgenstein, because people tend to confuse religious language with scientific language. And he says it's different from scientific language because A, tends to be concerned with certainties, not possibilities or probabilities. Christians typically don't say God probably exists or God may exist, but that he certainly exists. This is our faith, you know. By the way, Van Til said something very similar to that. the Bible, biblical epistemology, God certainly exists. B, though offering reasons for its statements, religion claims more certainty than its reasons appear to permit. So again, Wittgenstein is troubled by the fact that there's so little evidence to verify Christianity, but he makes that a minor consideration. C, religious language has a large emotional component to it. He's not quite saying what the positivist said, that religious language is emotive, that that's all it is, but he's saying it has a large emotional component. D, it makes belief or disbelief a moral issue, which it isn't in science, he thinks. Although, well, E, it regulates the conduct of those who use it. Immanuel Kant said that the ideas of religion are regulative rather than constitutive. They don't tell us about the world, but they tell us how to live. And Wittgenstein here says something rather similar. So he says religion is one language game, science is a completely different language game, and it's okay if you want to play this one, it's okay if you want to play that one, it's okay if you want to do that one on Sunday and do that one on Monday through Friday, but don't mix them up. Don't use religious convictions to try to overturn scientific conclusions. and don't use scientific observations to try to overturn a person's religious faith. These are two compartments. You know, this is a very common way of trying to refute objections against Christianity. Believers do it all the time. There's a realm of faith and there's a realm of reason. There's a realm of faith, there's a realm of science. These are doing two different things. Don't confuse them and you'll be okay. Essentially, Wittgenstein is buying into that particular model. So he's more open, in a way, to religious language, but insisting that it be compartmentalized. And that's a demand that I think Christians should not make. We should not allow anybody to tell us that our language must be compartmentalized. What the Bible tells us is that God rules not only over the church, but over the world. And that our faith, our view of creation, everything is created. Our view of government, our view of culture, our view of the arts, everything, every thought has to be brought under the dominion of Christ, including science. Okay. He also wrote a book that's kind of influential called On Certainty, a treatise on epistemology. He points out there are two kinds of doubt. Certainty is the opposite of doubt. You say that you're certain when you have no doubts. And there are two kinds of doubts. One is practical doubt that can be resolved by methods accepted in the language game. You doubt whether there's whether you have enough milk for breakfast. So you know how to resolve that doubt. You go and look in the refrigerator and see how much milk you have. So that's a practical doubt, and where there's a practical doubt, there's a method for resolving it. But then there are these other kinds of doubts the philosophers sometimes bring up. Doubt that there's such a thing as an external world outside your mind. Well, how would you ever resolve that doubt? There's no practical method of resolving it. Philosophers have debated this for centuries and never come to any conclusion about it. How do you resolve that doubt? How can I resolve the doubt if I came to doubt that I really have two hands? How would I resolve that doubt? So there's practical doubt, which is resolvable. There's this theoretical, philosophical, abstract, metaphysical doubt, which is not resolvable. And Wittgenstein would say, forget about it. Deal with it. Lose it. Doubt that the world has existed more than 5 minutes. So some doubt is illegitimate then. And again, this illegitimate doubt comes from using words like doubt, believe, be sure, be certain, outside of their normal context. These words are okay if you're using them for practical, everyday, ordinary life. See, we're calling this ordinary language philosophy. But they're illegitimate if you try to turn them into a philosophical metaphysics. Comments, page 232, number 3. Many useful points here about the usefulness, about the richness of language. There is irrationalism here, the desire to kind of open up the door to allow for any kind of language as long as anybody is using it as part of their life. But there's also rationalism here. The critique of metaphysics rests on the notion of a proper use. Wittgenstein is trying to tell us how to talk and how not to talk. And he's saying that we have to use our language in practical contexts, not in metaphysical contexts. Well, what's his authority for saying that? Metaphysics is also a language game. It's a game that people have played for many centuries. People have played that language game longer than they've played baseball, longer than they've had milk in the refrigerator, longer than they've had any other of these practical examples that Wittgenstein uses. So anyway, defining section E, defining the language game is very difficult. It's not obvious that general or metaphysical doubts are illegitimate. It's an interesting contrast, but I don't think he's quite made his point. Okay, now philosophy from about 1960 to the present. Wittgenstein's influence continues. although he died in 1952. What's going on now? What's gone on in the last 30, 40 years with regard to English and American philosophy? I'm just going to present some areas, some topics from the area of epistemology generally, learn a few meanings of a few terms. One, foundationalism. Here's an argument about knowledge, an argument about how we come to know things. And philosophers today distinguish between foundationalism, externalism, internalism, reliabilism, coherentism, various terms like that, and get so that you have some general idea of what these mean. First, foundationalism. This is a position which a lot of modern philosophers want to repudiate. They think that it's been held by people in the past, and they're trying to get beyond it, although there are still modified forms of foundationalism that exist today. A foundationalist is somebody who wants to have a clear structuring of beliefs. He wants to base his beliefs on a certain foundation, and he wants clarity as to how you justify your beliefs. When do you have a justified belief, and when do you not? The main distinction is between basic beliefs and non-basic beliefs. The basic beliefs would be, for Descartes, I think, therefore I am. That's the basic belief. Everything else is derived from that. For David Hume, the basic beliefs would be beliefs about our immediate sensations. And Hume thought that all the rest of knowledge has to be derived from that. So traditionally, you have the foundation, kind of incorrigible, the basic beliefs that can't be challenged, and then the other beliefs that are kind of worked out either deductively or inductively on the basis of that foundation. Top of 233, strong foundationalism assumes that the foundation is infallible, that we are absolutely certain about our foundational beliefs. And the foundation can include such as the following, either self-evident truths, like no part is greater than the whole, incorrigible propositions, Descartes' I exist, truths evident to the senses, like David Hume, non-basic beliefs are derived either deductively or inductively. Problems with strong foundationalism, and I'm using Jay Wood's book, I'm trying to think of its title. It may just be Epistemology, but Jay Wood is a Christian writer, publishes this book with InterVarsity Press. It's a nice summary of epistemology for Christians. Wood says, how do we know that we know, how do we assure ourselves about the foundation? And how do we know that the structure, where you have the foundation here and the non-basic beliefs up there, how do you know that that reflects reality? And Wood says, actually, we accept many beliefs without that kind of support. For example, we believe that there is an external world. We don't have any argument for that. There's no foundational truth that we can deduce that from or induce that from. So that's strong foundationalism. Page 234, more modest foundationalism, says that the foundational beliefs, the basic beliefs, are not absolutely certain, but they are innocent until proved guilty. That is, there's some. This is Thomas Reed. Thomas Reed says you got to start off with some common sense beliefs. There is an external world. Other people have minds like we do. This is a world of cause and effect. Some of those basic beliefs that we think are universal and so on. And we believe them. We can't help believing them. We got to believe them in order to live. We can't exactly prove that they are. And a lot of people don't even know what their basic beliefs are. But nevertheless, it's important to have them. Well, various problems connected with that, but I'll get into that again if we get as far as planting it. Number five, evidentialism, W.K. Clifford, who says it's always wrong to believe anything without sufficient evidence. This, of course, is compatible with logical positivism, for example. He says that you can't have any belief unless you're able to conceive of a verification scientifically. This is a kind of foundationalism in which evidence serves as the foundation. But how do you get evidence for the evidence? One criticism of this is that it leads to an infinite regress, etc. And of course, Reed would say, this is just not the way we get to know. I mean, there are all kinds of things that we would claim to know and we should claim to know without evidence. Again, other people have minds. That there is an external world, that there are causes and effects throughout the universe, and so on. Page 235, section B, coherentism. Pictures are knowledge as, thank you, Carrie, just put them on the table if you will. Coherentism, pictures are beliefs as a kind of circle. And here's one belief, here's another belief, here's another belief, and they're all kind of related together in a web of relationships, and they reinforce one another. And we try to come up with a group of beliefs that is consistent. So when I think about adding a new belief, the main question is, does this belief tie in with all the others? Is it consistent with all the others? Does this belief form a consistent system? If it doesn't, then I either have to reject that belief or I have to reject some others here, throw out some of these, put in a new one. But the goal is to have a consistent system. The goal is to have a coherent system. That has some advantages as an epistemology because this way it's not a matter of comparing each belief with the real world. And what is the real world anyway? Rather, it's a matter of comparing each belief with all the other beliefs. And that supposedly is easier to do. But it's kind of difficult to formulate that in a way that meets all the objections. Bottom of 235, reliabilism. This says that the way to really know something is to make sure that your mind is working right. Make sure that you're senses and your reasoning are reliable, that your epistemic organs, your epistemic faculties, your faculties of knowledge are operating properly. And you know you have knowledge if faculties are working right and if they're in a situation where they're designed to work. Now, the Matrix is an example of people who have pretty good minds, but they're completely deceived about the nature of the world because they're put in vats with electrodes attached to their heads, which have programmed them to think that they're having experiences that they're not really having. Now, that's an example of a mind that's working okay, but it's not in a situation where that mind can be expected to produce real knowledge. So that's the two criteria for reliabilism are one, that your mind is working okay. Two, it's in a situation where your mind can be expected to lead you to true beliefs. Well, there a lot can be said about that. 237, recent reformed philosophy. I want to mention some names here that you all should know. First, Abraham Kuyper, great Dutchman. He was taught by liberals and converted, became the leader of Dutch Neo-Calvinism. He tried to be a pastor, and he found his liberal teachings weren't doing him any good, sort of like Barth's story. And came to believe in the Bible. The more he read the Bible, he came to believe in the Bible and became the champion of what was called neo-Calvinism. Don't compare that with Richard Pratt's use of the phrase neo-Calvinism. He was a Renaissance man, a philosopher, a theologian. He founded and edited two newspapers, wrote regular columns, led a cessation from the Dutch Reformed Church to form another denomination. He was a J. Gresham Machen on top of all these other things. Founded a university, entered a political party, and became a leader in the Anti-Revolutionary Party. That was the party that was formed to oppose the ideas of the French Revolution. And he became a member of parliament and became prime minister of the Netherlands for a few years, 1901 to 1905. Very great figure, highly revered by most all Orthodox Reformed Christians, especially of Dutch background. And his basic idea is that of every inch of creation, Christ says, "This is mine." We have to take our faith and apply it to all areas of human culture, all areas of life, to journalism, to politics, to economics. He wrote this great, these lectures that he delivered at Princeton Seminary called Lectures in Calvinism. I think the most recent version has a different title, but he talks about Calvinism and art, and Calvinism and politics, and Calvinism and this, and Calvinism and that. Again, trying to apply the Reformed gospel to all the different areas of human work. He developed a theory of politics called sphere sovereignty, which is to say that God is sovereign over the state. There's also, of course, freedom for individuals, but not only for individuals. We often think of the questions of politics as being, here's the government and here's the individual, and how much freedom are we going to give to the individual. Kuyper said it's not just freedom of individuals that's important, it's also the freedom of groups, of structures, of the family, of the church, of different churches, of different denominations, of the labor union, the school, all of these institutions. And it's important not only that individuals be free, but also that families be free. And God is, God is the fundamental Lord, the fundamental sovereign, but he expresses his sovereignty over all kinds of different institutions, family, church, state, etc. And we go to the Bible, of course, to find out what the rights of the family are, what are the functions of the family, what should the family be free to do, how the family should be responsible to the state and yet free from the state in some ways, and all of that has to be worked out. So Kuyper began a lot of important reflection on the place of the Christian in society. He also wrote voluminously about common grace, much of which is not translated, but he believed that although there's an antithesis, as he put it, between believers and unbelievers, nevertheless, God has restrained sin, as common grace, restrained sin in the unbelievers so that in various limited ways, Christians and non-Christians can cooperate in areas of science, education, and so on. So his problem is asking, how far can we cooperate and to what extent must we be separate? And he does a lot of reasoning along that line. I'm sorry, I can't spend much time in discussion. Is it real quick?
Kuyper's emphasis upon that, is that what led to the split of the Protestant Reformed Church from the Christian Reformed
Church? The doctrine of common grace was the occasion for that. Number two, Herman Duyverd, who saw himself as a follower of Kuyper, very brilliant philosopher, probably the greatest philosopher the Netherlands has produced, founded a school of thought called the philosophy of the idea of law. I've given you some of the names. This is imported to the United States, the Institute for Christian, I'm sorry, to the new, to North America, as we say, the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto, has a number of people there, and Redeemer College in Canada is another school that's very much influenced by Duivierd. Duivierd distinguishes between pre-theoretical experience and theoretical thought. You'll remember this distinction from phenomenology. Heidegger has something like this. People like Husserl, Hartmann have used distinctions along this line. Pre-theoretical experience sees the world as a whole. Theory, including science and philosophy and theology and all the different disciplines, all the different academic disciplines, abstract various aspects of the world for close study, which is good and necessary. But these academic disciplines are in danger of losing the connections. You know, science will, well, mathematics will study numbers. But it may lose the connection between numbers and physical objects, for example. So it's important to keep, when you're doing science, it's important to, keep going back to your pre-theoretical experience and relating what you learn in science to what you're to your overall vision of reality. He distinguishes in reality between 15 modal aspects. I've related them there: numerical, spatial, kinetic. Mathematics, then, is the study of the numerical. Physics is the study of the spatial and the kinetic. We study logic, we study history, and so on and so forth. Theology is the study of faith. So each of these aspects has a science or a group of sciences connected with it. He has various views about the relationships here. His apologetic thrust is that what happens in non-Christian thought is that non-Christian thinkers try to reduce everything to one aspect. Marx tries to reduce everything to the economic aspect. The Greek atomists try to restrict everything to the material or the kinetic aspect. The logical positivists try to reduce everything to physical law. And what Duivierd says is that we've got to have a broader vision. We've got to get back. Now, it's true, you can make a pretty good argument for showing that everything is economics. You can also make a pretty good argument, as the Pythagoreans did, for saying that everything is mathematical. So you can take these modal aspects and use each one as a perspective to see all of reality. But use it only as a perspective. Don't go ruling out the other aspects in order to account for the world entirely by your own aspect. So it's only Christianity, he thinks, that has the breadth of vision to see the whole thing and to relate them all to one another, of course, by Duivierd's philosophy. So it's very, very intriguing and very, very useful. He has an analysis of the history of thought as a series of ground motives. There's form and matter among the ancient Greeks. There's nature and grace in the medieval period, in which they took the Greek form and matter scheme, said that that's okay when you're thinking about nature, and then they added to that the dimension of grace. And then when you get into the modern period and you're talking about Kant and so on, that distinction is secularized, and it becomes a distinction between nature and freedom. Very valuable way of looking at the history of thought. We haven't had time to exploit that, but very valuable. Now, I do have my disagreements with Duivierd. One of my earliest writings was a critique of Duivierd called The Amsterdam Philosophy, a Preliminary Critique, which you may find somewhere in the RTS library system. There was a lot of battles back in the late 60s and early 70s with militant young Duiverdians who were trying to take over things and whatnot, and so some of us wrote equally militant stuff on the other side. But I think Duivierd himself rejected biblical inerrancy, which is a major problem. And Duivierd and his disciples basically said the Bible is not you know, inerrant, not authoritative for economics, for government, for history, but only with regard to faith. Now, I think that's wrong. I think that's a compartmentalization, where it was kind of similar to Wittgenstein's. And I think we cannot accept that. The Bible is God's word for everything. God's word is authoritative for everything it talks about, and we can't compartmentalize it and try to restrict it to one area. Duiverd basically thought what the Bible does is it gives you a new heart, gives you a new vision, gives you regeneration, and from there, from that point, you're on your own. You do your science like other scientists, but you do it out of this regenerate vision. But you don't go to the Bible to learn anything about history. You don't go to the Bible to learn anything about relevant to science and so on and so forth. I think that's restricting the nature of the Bible unduly. And then number three, at the bottom of 239, Alvin Plantinga, who may be the most distinguished not only Christian epistemologist, but the most distinguished epistemologist in the world today, very much respected by secularists as well as by Christians, has developed a view of knowledge in a meticulously argued, profound series of books called Warrant, three volumes on Warrant, three big fat volumes on Warrant, and certainly a thinker that needs to be treated at greater length. I'm sorry I don't have the time for it, but he distinguishes, you know, here's this question: what is knowledge? And traditionally people have said knowledge is justified true belief. Okay, if you say I know something, you have a belief about it, and you think that it's true. So true belief. But, you know, if you just guess, you know, you say, I guess that the population of Paris is such and such, and it just turns out to be that. Did you know that was the population of Paris? No, you just guessed. You had a true belief, but it wasn't justified. You didn't have a reason. You didn't have a basis for saying what you say. So traditionally, knowledge is defined as justified true belief. But this concept of justification is mysterious. What is justification? W.K. Clifford would say justification is finding evidence. You shouldn't believe anything unless you have evidence. But of course, Thomas Reed points out that there are a lot of things we believe and rightly believe that we don't have evidence for, that we don't have an argument for. And Plantinga agrees with Reed in this respect. Plantinga thinks it's okay to believe in many things without evidence or argument, the existence of an external world, the existence of other minds. And here's what Plantinga adds to Reed. Plantinga says it's okay to believe in God without evidence or argument. After all, that's what we all do at some point if we grow up in Christian homes. When you were 3 years old and you grew up in a Christian home, you probably believed in God, and you should have believed in God. Your belief was justifiable, but you didn't have evidence. You didn't have an argument for it. Plantinga says that's okay. That's the way it works. Plantinga is a kind of reliabilist, externalist, internalists justify knowledge by pointing to something within the mind. Externalists justify knowledge by describing how the mind is related to something outside itself. Plantinga is an externalist, and Plantinga says, you know, if your mind is working okay, this is the kind of thing that's going to happen. You're going to find yourself in a situation, maybe a Christian family, maybe looking up at the stars at night, where belief in God just comes upon you. And that's the way it should be. That's the way God made us. Plantinga calls this reformed epistemology because he takes his cue from Calvin. Everybody has a sense of deity. Everybody has a sense of God's existence. And they may not have evidence or argument, but they believe, and they rightly believe. Now, Plantinga says that you could be wrong. I mean, it's okay for Christians to believe in God based on their family training. It's also okay for Muslim kids to believe in Allah on the basis of their early training. So a justified belief, a belief that's justified in this kind of way, can be wrong. And it can be refuted by evidence or argument. But nevertheless, it's okay to start off without any evidence or argument. You can improve your knowledge, your level of knowledge, through evidence and through argument, but you don't have to begin that way. And that's basically Plantinga's argument. He says belief in God is basic. It's a foundation. This is a kind of foundationalism, but it's not the classical foundationalism. Belief in God is not a conclusion that we come to through argument. It's a basic belief. It's a place where we start, not a place that we achieve by argument. But it's a basic belief, and it's a properly basic belief. That means that it's a belief that we ought to have. But it's not irrefutable. It's a belief that can be refuted by argument. Page 241, Gordon Clark, a very interesting figure, uses the word presuppositionalism and applies it to himself. He sees systems, first of all, he's very critical of empiricism. He says there's very little that we know through sense experience, if anything at all. Our senses tend to deceive us. Our senses mislead us. So there's really nothing that we can be sure of if it comes out of what we see or hear, so on. So where does knowledge come from? Well, he says basically knowledge is an axiomatic system. It's a kind of a coherentist view. Knowledge is an axiomatic system. You can describe it sort of like Euclid's geometry. You get certain presuppositions, and within those presuppositions, you can argue and develop ideas out of them. And you test. Now, how do you choose between one system and another? And here's the Christian system. Here's the Muslim system. Basically, you decide between them through logic, all right? Logic enables you to choose the most consistent system. And it's also, of course, important to choose a system which is rich enough to meet your needs. I can give you a consistent system. 1 + 1 = 2, 2 + 2 = 4. That's my system. But it doesn't solve your counseling problems. So you need a rich system, a system which encompasses everything. In this way, Clark is a disciple of Kuyper. His best book, I think, is one of his earliest ones called A Christian View of Men and Things, where he tries to show how a Christian worldview applies to politics and philosophy and epistemology and ethics and everything like that. But he puts logic. You know, for him, logic is tremendously important. Logic is the mind of God. God thinks in logic. God thinks in Aristotelian syllogisms, not Russell, but Aristotle, because Clark believed that Russell was wrong and Aristotle was right. And so logic is the mind of God. Clark was not patient with people like me who said that logic depends on the logical syllogism won't help you unless you got good premises, and often your premises come from sense experience. Clark didn't like that at all. He wasn't moved by that kind of thing. For him, logic is the main test. The test is logic, and the test is richness. Then Van Til on page 247 in my unexpurgated text here, Roman numeral 5, do a search on it if you can't find it. He's my mentor. We finally get to the truth of things after all these surveying the thousands of years of thought. Van Til, Bible-believing Reformed, tremendous emphasis on creation. Two circles, went in to class every day and put two circles on the board, the creator and the creature. All facts, therefore, are created by God, or they are God. There are two kinds of facts, the fact of God himself and the facts that God has created. All facts are pre-interpreted by God. They come about by God's eternal plan. So there are no such things as uninterpreted facts or brute facts. Our job as thinkers is not to come up with an original interpretation of the world. Our job is to reproduce the interpretation that God himself has placed on his creation. Facts and laws, therefore, are correlative. The world is one and many by analogy with the Trinity. Van Til speaks about analogical knowledge, and people have put different constructions on this, but I think all he meant when he talked about knowledge being analogical, he didn't mean that, as Thomas Aquinas did, that we can only express, talk about God in figures of speech and things like that. What Van Til means is our job is to think God's thoughts after him. Our job is to think in accord with God's revelation. See, Van Til is saying you may not compartmentalize your faith as Wittgenstein tells you to do and as Duiver did in his worst moments. Rather, all of our knowledge has to be governed by our faith presuppositions. All of our knowledge has to be governed by the scriptures. We have to come to know God and know his word in a way that he approves. And that's the number one consideration in epistemology. It's the number one consideration in philosophy. Well, then, scripture provides presuppositions to us. These are not just like planting as properly basic ideas. Because for planting, a properly basic proposition can be overturned by evidence and argument. For Van Til, a true presupposition cannot be overturned by argument. Because if you presuppose the God of the Bible, setting the standards for evidence and argument. The presupposition governs your reasoning. It tells you how to reason. And so you must reason accord with the presupposition. That means that a presupposition cannot be refuted by evidence. Now, people do change their presuppositions sometimes, but that's not because of evidence and argument. That's because of something going on in the heart. Okay? There's a vast difference, then, between regenerate knowledge and unregenerate knowledge. Van Til is not opposed to the use of evidence, bottom of 248. People often say that he is, but he's not. All he wants to say is that when we use evidence, we use it in accord with our presupposition. The Bible tells us how to use evidence. We don't use it the way David Hume does, saying that there's no testimony sufficient to establish a resurrection. Rather, we do it the way the Bible does, saying that if God tells us the resurrection occurred, we must believe that the resurrection occurred. Van Til puts a lot of emphasis on the noetic effects of sin, middle of 249. Sinners, this is just Romans 1, sinners know that God exists, and they know him, Romans 1:21, knowing God. But they don't want to have God in their knowledge. They repress that knowledge. And they suppress it. They exchange the truth for a lie, and so on. There's a lot of difficulty in understanding Van Til here, the difference between the believer and the unbeliever. Both of them know God. The unbeliever represses the truth, but the unbeliever does express the truth sometimes, as Satan did when he quoted scripture to Jesus, as the Pharisees did when they said that God is one. So just how is it that believing knowledge and unbelieving knowledge are at odds. Well, Van Til, I think, is not entirely consistent there. I've tried to discuss that in a chapter in my book on Van Til. Van Til is responsible for the concept of rationalism and irrationalism. He says that all non-Christians are caught up in that, and that's what I've been trying to emphasize to you. Apologetics. Van Til was a professor of apologetics. He says the traditional method is trying to start with the world as if the world were not created and interpreted by God, and then trying to deduce from this knowledge of the world that God exists. And Van Til says that's wrong. What you have to do instead is to begin with God and to recognize that no reasoning is possible apart from God, and to show the unbeliever that even his unbelief, he can't even express his unbelief unless God exists. So God is the transcendental source of meaning, that term taken from Kant. Without God, there is no meaning, no rationality, no order, no structure, no anything. Without God, everything is chaos, which is to say, without God, there is nothing. And it's the job of the apologist to show nothing less than that. It's not enough to show that a God exists after Aquinas's proofs. It's not enough to show that Christianity may probably or possibly be true. What we have to do is show that Christianity, unless Christianity is true, nothing is true. And that's what Van Til calls his transcendental argument. And well worth following up in your studies of apologetics. Very bold move, I can't say that I agree with it in all its details. But I think it's a great challenge, and I think his message is probably the message that the world most needs to hear at this time, and that the church needs to hear. That even our intellectual work has to be subject to God's word. And if I started off by this course by telling you that, I'm happy that I'm able to conclude the course on the same note, bringing every thought captive to the Lordship of Christ.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.